Hello, my name is Michael Han, and you're listening to the Hoodrat Recap Podcast.
We got bored, so we started a podcast about the best bar band in the land, man. This is the Hoodrat Recap, and we are back. We are your steady stream of the unified scene, all the news and reviews of the band that you love, we love, and Hurley wanted to see him before his plane crashed on Lost. Hello, everybody. This is Stage Right Mike on the mic, and I can talk hold steady all night. And when I like to talk hold steady heavy, I like to throw up the rat signal, and the Hood Rat Pack has assembled. And first of all, we always start out with the unified scene's very own King of Queens, Gasper, how you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, Mike, but you know what? I've been trying to get people to call me Robert Frost.
Why is that, Gasper?
Because I got gray lines and I take the road less traveled by.
How's that working out for you?
Not so good, man. Not so good. People keep calling me Frosted Flakes.
They're great!
God. Sometimes I just want to call you Fruit Loops.
Fair enough.
Man. I'm sorry, everybody.
And that's the sound of our third mic and producer, Kevin, as whenever. How you doing, Kev?
I am doing okay. I think it's been a minute since we've checked in with the scene, so it's nice to be back with the Hood Rats chatting all things hold steady. We have a great episode today. But first, if everybody remembers, we got new artwork thanks to Hurricane Jess. Everybody's seen it. We still have the contest going for the posters. I know we'll be announcing a new winner at the end. Didn't we get a great segment?
Yeah, Jeff did a segment for us we like to call First Night. It's where you tell us your first time seeing the band, and let's check it out, what you had to say.
So, yeah, I tend to go to gigs on my own, especially because my boyfriend doesn't like the hold steady, which is kind of funny because I feel like most of the time it's you guys, your wives don't like the hold steady or whatever, and you're going on your own and seeing the gang. But yeah, this time my boyfriend's really not into the hold steady, so I went on my own, which I often do. And I was a bit nervous because I didn't know anyone, and I was thinking, I'm not sure what the vibe is going to be here, you know, like, and I was queuing up, and I immediately spotted Rob, you know, you've had on your podcast before. He's kind of like, everyone recognises him in the UK. I started calling him the kid, you know, from the net or whatever, because literally everyone seems to recognise him. He's always posting in positive posting. I just immediately saw him and I was like, hey, I recognize you. And he's like, yeah, of course you do. And immediately I just felt at ease. Like, he was with Ben. Ben, have you also had Ben on the podcast, right?
I don't think Ben we have, Fisco. But we've definitely met Ben.
Yeah. But there was a big, oh yeah, because you met in Chicago, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but there was just like a crew of them and they obviously all knew each other. And they immediately just like welcomed me in and I just felt like really safe and at home, you know. And for me, as at the time 22-year-old among these like bunch of guys, I was like, this is really weird. Like, I should probably not feel as comfortable as I do. And, you know, we did the sound check and then we wandered off. They're like, oh, everyone's going to a pub, like it's around the corner. And I was like, okay, cool. And I was thinking, this is literally the beginning of Taken. Like, I'm just walking around. I'm walking down these like dark streets in Camden with these bunch of guys I don't even know. But now, you know, we went to the Admiral. Did I make that up? Anyway, we went to one of the pubs that we always go to. They always go to at the Weekender. And yeah, just immediately I was like, okay, this is like I'm part of the scene now. And I'd only been to the soundtrack. I hadn't been to the gig yet. I only knew a few of the albums. Like, I think I knew Separation Sunday really well, and I listened to Stay Positive, and that was about it. Like, I hadn't listened to much, and I was like cramming the new album quickly. You know how you do, you're like, okay, I need to learn this. But yeah, immediately I was just like, okay, this is such a nice group. And yeah, and then obviously the gig blew me away and I was immediately like, this is my new favorite band. Sorry, The White Stripes. Sorry, Jack White. I'm afraid you're taking like second place now. And yeah, it was just magical. And unfortunately, I only went to the Saturday night, and then immediately as soon as the tickets dropped for this year, I was like, I need to get every single one, and you know, went to see Craig Finn with all the guys again in October, and yeah, just immediately like engrossed in the scene, which is magic, and I'd never experienced anything like that in any, you know, fandom, like music kind of, you know, fan group. So yeah, just amazing.
I think like a lot of us, we all have a story we could relate to, and Jess's story about her first night, I'm sure, is true like a lot of ours.
All right, guys. So now we get to speak to Michael Hann. He's the author of the new book, The Gospel of the Hold Steady. He's also the author of Denim and Leather, The Rise and Fall of the New Wave of British Heavy Metal. And I think between the three of us, we bought six versions of this book, right, guys? We all got, Kevin told us it was on audiobook and we thought he was joking around. And then, because it's a coffee book, we was like, how do you get a coffee book on audio? But I think we liked both versions, or I really enjoyed both versions of the book. So let's get in there and see what Michael has to say about this.
All right, let's do it. We're talking to Michael Hann, author of The Gospel of the Hold Steady and Denim and Leather, best book of 2022 from Rolling Stone and Spin and The Times. He's also a freelance writer for many outlets and the former music editor of The Guardian. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
So The Gospel of the Hold Steady, man, like, what an amazing project. Like, how did this come to fruition? Were you approached by the band or?
Yeah, Craig came to me. I've been friends with Craig since what gets remembered as the Hold Steady's first visit to London, but was in fact their second visit. So that was early in 2007. After their first show they did at the Hoxton Bar and Grill, or Bar and Kitchen, whatever it was called then. I'd left the venue and the publicist texted me to say, do you want to come back and meet Craig? And I said, no, you're right, because I hate meeting bands after shows. Why do they want to meet complete strangers when they've just come off stage? Why do I want to try and think of someone to something to say to someone I don't know? But I was persuaded to go back, and we ended up in the club at, you know, 2:30 in the morning with all the other chairs put on top of tables. And Craig pulled out his key card and said, do you know where I'm staying? And fortunately for him, he was on my cab route home. So I dropped him off, and we've more or less been friends ever since. So when they were coming up to the 20th anniversary, he got in touch with me and asked if I'd be interested in taking on the book. I guess based on the fact that the band trust me, but also I know enough to know what questions to ask. And I don't know, maybe Rob Sheffield was too busy and too expensive. Who knows? I did not ask.
So you do an amazing job of capturing the Hold Steady, like really eloquently. It's one of the things that struck me about the book is that there's a momentum to it that, being somebody who knows the band so well, I still found myself going like, what's going to happen? Like they start and then you have this, you know, their problem period, and then if they rise again, like what's your process to capture them like that?
Well, first, the reason I did it as an oral history was, if I'm going to be absolutely ruthlessly honest about this, is that it wasn't a huge amount of money. And an oral history, basically, once you've done the interviews, the big part of the work is done. Second, I'm quite good at oral histories. My first book, Denim and Leather, was an oral history, and I knew that worked well. I've done a few long oral histories in print as well. It's a good format. It also frees you from having to make critical judgments yourself. You know, I was in no great desire to say necessarily what I thought of Teeth Dreams in print. You know, they're my friends, they're my favourite band. I don't want to be the person who has to do that stuff. But it becomes obvious what the narrative arc is. And if we're honest, most bands have the same narrative arc. They're excited and new. They reach their peak of success. And then they start falling out. The interesting thing about the Hold Steady is that there's the fourth act, where they become friends again and start making great music again. So within that, I think the main thing on my mind was to try and make sure that there was new information within there. And maybe some stories that people hadn't heard before. And also some stuff about the Dark Times they hadn't really spoken about very much publicly. So I think, although we all knew that Tad had alcohol problems, I think there's more detail about exactly what happened to him than has ever been told before. There's more about the doubts that were existing within the band in the period after Heaven Is Whenever and through to, well, through to basically them coming back in 2016. So that, I think, provided value for fans and provided them with more insight into the personalities. I should also say another reason it was an oral history. It was that the band were insistent everyone be interviewed, which is perfectly fine. But I know from previous interactions with Bobby that he answers monosyllabically. So if it was going to be separate interviews, then the Bobby chapter would have been about a page and a half. Whereas, as it is, I think back to Springsteen talking about the making of Darkness on the Edge of Town, where he said there isn't actually that much Clarence Clemons on the album, and Clarence was very unhappy about it at the time. But it's used in such a way that you think there's quite a lot of sax. So with Bobby, all his interventions are so perfectly comedically timed that it makes it seem, I think, that there's more input from him than there really is. So, yeah, Bobby was by a distance the shortest interview.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. In that situation, when you're doing an oral history, are you talking to all the guys together on one call with their interplaying, or are you doing them individually? Because there are some stories that come up. There are some things from the past, especially in the Dark Times, where, you know, sometimes artists won't be comfortable saying that when sitting next to them. So do you find it's easier to do together or separate or a combination of both?
Oral histories, I think, work better if you interview everyone separately, because then you can put what someone else has said to the next interviewee. Mm-hmm. In a way, that's harshest on the first interviewee. Well, there's advantages and disadvantages being to the first interviewee. If you're the first person, you're basically setting the narrative. In this case, my first interview was Craig. But on the other hand, you're then setting yourself up to be disagreed with by other people. And there's a certain amount of that, which is understandable because, you know, memories are porous and they are not perfect. I've discovered that before when doing oral histories. Now, no one in this band is deliberately setting out to mislead, but they have different recollections of things. And that tension adds something to a book. When it's an oral history, you don't have to do the, okay, well, I find out what the absolute truth is, which is your requirement if you're writing a straight narrative book. If you're doing an oral history, you can just let the different accounts fly and sit next to each other and leave it to the band or to the reader to decide what they think the actual truth is. Yeah, but the truth in rock and roll, well, as Craig is fond of saying, you know, rock and roll means, well, quoting the Truckers, rock and roll means well, but it keeps telling young boys lies. And yeah, a part of the mythology of rock and roll is the stories that get exaggerated and get changed and get altered by the passage of time. And I'm perfectly happy to contribute to that mythology in this way.
Now, you bring up Bobby being difficult to talk. You do a great job of getting Galen, too, which Galen's not normally as vocal member of the band. Was that difficult to get him to talk as much as well? Or
no, not at all. Galen is perfectly chatty and talkative. I just think people don't really talk to him that much. I mean, the focus in all bands is the singer and the lead guitarist. That's always been the way since time immemorial. When you think of Led Zeppelin, you don't think, I really want to know what John Paul Jones has to say. You want to know what Page has to say and what Plant has to say. It's inevitable. There's often a source of tension in groups. I'm not sure it is so much with the Hold Steady. I think Galen is quite happy to not be the spokesperson. But he is a man with opinions and a man with views and a man with a great knowledge of rock and roll music. So it's just a question of him being in the being in place to be asked those questions. I suspect that had he been part of interviews going back to the early days, then people would have a very different of opinion of him. It's just that people think of him as the silent bass player. He is not, in fact, silent. He's just not really spoken to very much by people.
Yeah. That's a very interesting point, because even as all of us, we've seen them countless times as fans and whatnot and gotten to be around them, we've learned that even at the, you know, the VIP meet and greets and Q&As before, Bobby and Galen don't usually talk. It's a lot of Craig, as you expect and as you stated, but, you know, Franz does chime in a lot. There is a lot, but it just always seems like the rhythm section, when those things happen, they're always the most silent. So maybe as we go to the next couple, we need to make sure we kind of throw questions out specifically for Galen to see if it opens a door for him to talk.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's also the sound check Q&As. Obviously, Craig takes most of the questions. I mean, I've hosted quite a few of those, and I try to ask things of all the band. But Galen, if you ask him a direct question, he'll give you a good answer. It's just that otherwise he's content to leave it to everyone else. He's not a tremendously shy person or anything. It's just that's the way a band works.
Yeah, so Michael, you're talking about the voices of the bands there, and it seems like in this third iteration of the band here, the third stage, it seems like Craig's been coming, and you kind of write about it, he's been coming forward more, kind of being the voice of the band. But it seems like he's doing it kind of reluctantly, and then it seemed like the band was kind of waiting for him to do that. Do you think that's an accurate perception or no?
I think earlier in the history of the band, they were very concerned with the notion that they not be, you know, a band with a leader. And that changed, I think, undoubtedly when Tad got ill and when Craig started making solo records. You know, it became apparent that no one's desires were getting completely fulfilled here. And yeah, there's no point pretending there has not been tension between Tad and Craig for a long time and between Tad and Franz. But again, you need to remember that bands are workplaces. You know, they are not just, you know, hey, this happy band of fellows who've come together to spread the majestic world of rock and roll. They're workplaces. And, you know, think about the people you work with and imagine if you were asked to spend 250 nights a year with them, traveling on one bus, sleeping within 6 feet of each other. You would kill each other by the end of it. I mean, most sane people would. So in a way, it's a miracle that rock and roll bands last as long as they do. But when they returned in 2016, yeah, Craig was very much the leader. I think everyone was actually happy with that. I think Tad had made a degree of peace with the notion that he didn't have to be in charge of things. The fact that, as they say, the fact that he had Steve in the band who was his friend provided, you know, someone else for him to turn to. And Craig was, yeah, very ready to take that role at that point. I think the experience of doing the solo records altered his perception of, you know, what he could do. He does not view the Hold Steady as his employees, but because they're not. But working solo records with a band who said, just do this, play this, play that, and they did it was, I think, I don't want to put words into his mouth, but I think that was a slightly revelatory experience for him. But also, because they're not now trying to decide everything together, there's a much clearer sense of purpose. But also, let's bear in mind, there is much less to decide than there used to be when they were doing 200 shows a year. And, well, I was about to say making a record every year, but they are making a record every year again now. It seems, you know, as Dave Gottlieb says in the book, it seems like, you know, a bunch of men who appreciate what they have now. So they're no longer quibbling about what they don't have. They're just thankful for the fact that they get to play rock music to crowds who love them, and they get to make some money from it as well. All that stuff. Once a band is able to live with a certain degree of peace with themselves and to make a bit of money as well, things become a lot easier. Yeah, a band that is touring all the time, not making money, and squabbling, well, that's kind of recipe for misery.
Yeah. Now, you bring up the Q&A at things like the soundcheck party at Massive Nights. I know you've hosted a bunch of those, as you said. So we kind of opened this up to some of our listeners as well, and they threw us a few questions. And so Kat from Vermont asks, as someone so familiar with the band, is there anything that surfaced during the project that surprised you or that you hadn't known prior to doing these interviews?
I hadn't known that Tad had had to go back into hospital a second time. That was new to me. I hadn't realised, actually, how ruthless is the wrong word, but how sure Craig could be about the other members needing to change their ideas. There was a point where he said to me, you know, it was good that other guys thought the band might end because it bucked them up. I was surprised at that. In terms of facts, there wasn't so much that surprised me. And there were a couple of things that didn't get in the book because the band felt there's kind of no need to rake that over. So it would be inappropriate of me to talk about them here. They weren't huge things at all. Mm-hmm. They were just things about the internal workings. But those didn't come as a desperate surprise to me, I've got to say, because they're the kind of things that all bands go through. So, no, but things, I mean, Craig and I have been really quite good friends for how long? 16 and a half years now. So, you know, he's seen my kids grow up. You know, he's been around to my house countless times. We spent a lot of time together. And in that time, I've heard quite a lot of the interior life of the Hold Steady, the stuff that doesn't necessarily get in magazines. So there wasn't a whole lot to actually have me go, oh my God, did that really happen? there wasn't a huge amount that shocked me, I've got to say.
Okay. Was there anything that that needed to get cut from the book that disappointed you that you would have liked to have seen have got in that for time purposes or space purposes, perhaps?
There were a couple of specific things. You know, Tad talking about the nature of his problems and then making things more vague. And I was like, well, I'm not sure that really does anything because I think people know what the problems were. But, you know, I think he's thinking about his family there and trying to make things as within the constraints of being honest about alcohol and drugs problems, trying to make things as vague as possible. The one or two things, talking about the recording of Separation Sunday and the party nature of the sessions, where I was asked maybe, you know, tone down some of the specifics. Mm-hmm. But again, guys, I don't think anyone will be terribly surprised by this. But there was no narrative thread that needed to come out because anyone was unhappy with it. I think before the Minneapolis book event, I read the transcript of that. And Franz said that when he first spoke to me, he said, well, you know, what's the nature of this? And I apparently said, well, warts and all. And they were all on board with the notion that there was nothing that could not be talked about. And at times I did feel I was asking quite intrusive questions. But again, I think because I've known those, Craig is my friend, the others I know, but because they have seen me around dressing rooms and shows and pubs for donkey's years, I don't think there's any great conception that I might suddenly run away and go, ha 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 ha, now I can unveil the awful truth about you to the world.
I do feel it's a real testament to how comfortable the band is with you in their orbit, because even when you read and have the story about Tad in Chicago, that very famous festival where the show is a disaster and his mom is there and Bobby wants to punch him. Like, a lot of bands, just that would, to me, like, thinking on the other side, knowing bands the way I do, like, a lot of times that was stuff that they would just leave out because you don't want to bring up mom in those situations and stuff. And like, this is all going on while this show is happening. But they were just so comfortable to kind of leave that wart in there for you to tell and for people to kind of, you know, warts and all is really a great way to describe it because it does show the humanity to the bands. And sometimes you read these biographies or even these oral histories and they want to kind of whitewash it a little bit because they don't want the fan base to realize, like, there is a real humanity to it. And, you know, having someone's mom be at a show where he's completely inebriated on stage and the drummer wants to punch him in the like, it's, that's a very real gritty warts and all story that I was glad to read and really stuck out to me as I was going through the book.
I think it might have been different if they weren't in such a good place now. I think if they were just doing the shows to make payroll, as they did for 2 or 3 years in the mid-2010s, and they weren't all getting along well, that might have been different. But now, I think the sense is so much time has passed. They've made peace with themselves and with each other that actually that stuff is now quite funny to them. It's no longer resentments. I would also imagine that with Tad, you know, Tad talks about being part of the recovery community. And of course, part of 12-step is, you know, putting your resentments aside and making peace with your past. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if some element of that feeds into it as well. I mean, this is now a band of grown-ups. And that's what it's kind of hard to, it's hard to remember that sometimes when we are all at the shows and everyone is drunk and Howard Roberts is plying frozen margaritas and pints of beer upon everyone within sight. It's hard to remember that they are grown-ups these days and they behave like grown-ups. Although, I mean, it's interesting. I often think about the division that happened in the whole study when Tad stopped drinking, which is something they all talk about as well. You know, they lost their leader. They lost the man who drove them into battle. And they became a different band very quickly, almost overnight. You know, the whole study that I first saw was this sloppy, joyous rock and roll band. And the sloppiness was part of the attraction, the fact that Craig will be slurring words, someone will be falling over. And one of my favourite Hold Steady memories is Tad at the Rescue Rooms in Nottingham, a little club that has a stairway up the side of the stage to a little balcony. And Tad walked up the stairway, it was on his side of the stage, to start soloing. He was soloing triumphantly at the top of the steps. And then decided he would slide down the banister to carry on soloing. He slid down it and at the bottom went face first and landed on his wrist. And Craig told me the next day he fractured his wrist and carried on playing the show. I don't know if he really did fracture his wrist, but you know, it's a Man Who Shot Liberty Valance thing. Print the legend. So, yeah, part of me misses that. But then Tad got sober and I remember the first time I saw them after that was the Terminal 5 shows with the Truckers. So when's that? 2008? It was the year Obama got elected. So yeah, 2008. And they were a juggernaut. Instead, this awesome, powerful force, absolutely precise. So they both lost something and they gained something. And the place they are at now, I think, is sort of in that sweet spot where, you know, I'm sure we all listen to the live recordings that they post on Bandcamp. And you can hear the songs evolve. You know, old songs change. I mean, they're not sloppy anymore, but there's a sense of freedom about them. And I think that comes with being grown up and being relaxed enough to know what they want, but also professional enough to be able to deliver a really strong, solid show every night after night.
So one of the great features about this book is you took so much of the fan submissions, and the range of those submissions are all over the place, from extremely touching to outright hysterical. I'm thinking of the cry fart story specifically, but was it difficult to choose from the submissions? Did you get a ton of them and it was just a lot to weed through, or how was that process like?
There were fewer than I thought there would be, to be honest. I thought everyone would send something in, given how devoted the fan base is. After I'd submitted the manuscript, and the band went and got a few more as well. I think maybe we didn't talk about that. I was fine. I'd done my work. I'd sent the manuscript in. That was something they were insistent on. It was not something sorry, Hold Steady fans. It was not something I was keen on. That's from my days as a newspaper section editor. And whenever you do things with readers, it's just, oh, fucking hell, the fucking readers. God. you know, submitting these barely literate things. When we sent out the appeal, there were a couple of things I was insistent on. And one is, do not tell us about your first Hold Steady gig. Because that's the kind of thing everyone always does. You know, tell us your memories of this group. Oh, let's talk about my first ever show. But everyone's first ever show is fundamentally the same story. So what I wanted was things that were unique, or things that talk very specifically about how the band had touched their lives. And actually, the ones that came in, some of them didn't require very much editing, some of them did require a bit of knocking into shape. But because it was the voice of the fans, I was not trying to get it into a house style, and that made it easier. But it's been interesting, actually, to see that the responses from the fans, and also in the reviews. People saying that chapter is one of the defining things about the book. But of course, you know, my attitude to this is different from the band's. You know, the band is all about celebrating the fans, whereas for me, I want to celebrate the band. I am a fan. I know what it's like to be a fan. I want to celebrate the fucking band. So I think it was a really good thing for them to do. You know, no matter what my doubts were at the beginning, it obviously really, really worked. And it is nice to give people who've been a part of that story, because we all of us as Hold Steady fans, we know, even if we don't know who the people are, we know the names of people. We know, oh, so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. And it is great those people get a chance to shout out for themselves and for their favourite band in this book. And I can't think of any other band that would do something like this.
I did want to ask, as you bring it up, because of your personal situation, that first show that you went to for the Hold Steady, was that as a fan? Was that a work thing? Did a publicist invite you? Like, what made you sort of first experience them? Was it a work thing, or was it a like a professional versus a personal, or how did you kind of discover them?
Well, I came to music journalism late. I've been around the house in journalism. My first job was on a medical trade magazine. I was there for 4 years. Then I was the chief copy editor on a politics weekly. Then I edited a soccer magazine for 4 years. I joined The Guardian in 2001. And initially, I was editing a kind of weekly media digest section. But the job I'd always wanted since I was a student was to edit their Friday art section. And I got that job in 2006, I think. But I was an obsessive music fan, and I bought Almost Killed Me and Separation Sunday off iTunes on the strength of the Pitchfork reviews. So when Boys and Girls in America was announced in, it was announced in the UK in October 2006, something like that. It came out a few months later in the UK than in the US. I'd been listening to the first two records pretty obsessively, and I sent a note straight back to the publicist saying, thank God someone has picked this band up for the UK. And so when they came over, I was there professionally in the sense that, you know, I didn't have to pay to get in, and I had an interest in seeing this band to see whether they really were worth covering fully. But no, I was there as a fan. I was there because I wanted to see the show. Bear in mind, this is the infancy of YouTube. So I had no idea. I'd seen photos of them, but I had no idea what they were like on stage. You know, it's not like I had some clear idea that Craig would come out this crazy gesticulating figure and that France would be all flourishes and bottles of red wine and Tad would be windmilling guitars. I honestly expect them to be, here's another American indie band who kind of stand there and don't really do very much. And yeah, that first time I saw them, I was knocked sideways. And it's interesting talking to people who've been with the Craig Finn experience before the Hold Steady. You know, the writer Michelangelo Matos from Minnesota, who, you know, I know from socials, I've commissioned as an editor before, and we talk. I mean, he likes the Hold Steady, but despite really being a dance music guy. But he says, oh no, the thing for me was Lift a Puller, because, you know, I saw Lift a Puller in little clubs in Minnesota, and I think everyone's first experience of Craig Finn is the one that they take with them. That's what they think is the definitive thing. And it's kind of like The Fall. I think everyone's favourite Fall album is the first Fall album they heard. So for me, it's Perverted by Language. It's when you hear or see something unique and remarkable that no one else is doing. That moment is the one that imprints itself on your mind. So yeah, from then on, I was pretty obsessive. I think I've only missed one Hold Steady London show since then. And that was because I was meant to go to see the Wrens that night. But in fact didn't go to see the Wrens that night because my wife thought she'd lost a contact lens in her eye and had to go to hospital to try and get them to take it out. And then when she got home, she said, oh, actually, the contact lens wasn't in my eye. Sorry, just waste an entire evening. So I didn't see any band that night. But I did watch an AC/DC live DVD from 1977 that night. So it wasn't all wasted.
There you go. Not bad. There you
go. So another fan question. Rob from the UK would like to know, is it true that you're responsible for Craig supporting the English football team, Queen's Park Rangers?
That is indeed my doing. I am a season ticket holder at QPR. I have been for many years. They are a terrible team. This season they are doing unbelievably badly. They've won one game at home this calendar year. One game. Sunderland, Coventry and Blackburn have all won more times at Loftus Road than QPR have. But yeah, I mean, he's a sports guy. And when they came over, he was inquiring about sports. Said, oh, I've got a friend who supports Spurs. Should I support Spurs? I support Spurs if you want. twat. And said, but, you know, I can take you to Loftus Road if you'd like to see football. And the first game he came to, I think, was QPR v Liverpool, when that'd been 2010, 2011, something like that. And QPR were 2-0 down with 13 minutes to go. It was not a very good QPR team, but we were in the Premier League at that point. And Liverpool were a good team. But QPR came back to win 3-2, scoring the winning goal in injury time. And on the coverage of the TV coverage of the game, it was live on Sky Sports, watching the highlights back, my season ticket seats are right by the manager's dugout. So it's not a very good view of the game because you're so low down. But it's kind of, you're very close to things. It's quite exciting from that point of view. And when the QPR winning goal went in, the cameras panned to the dugouts. And behind the QPR manager, you can see me and all the people around me going absolutely fucking mental. And Craig standing there looking slightly baffled. Yeah. But on the way out, he said, "That's cute. It's not a big ground, Loftus Road. It holds 18,000 people. But the noise that night was extraordinary." And on the way, he said, "That's the most amazing atmosphere I've ever encountered at a sports event." And that night got strange. A bunch of us QPR fans who work in music journalism or music PR went to the pub, and a man called Ian Montone approached us. I don't know how he recognised any of us. He must have met one of them before. Ian Montone, at that point, was doing some sort of personal management role for QPR's midfielder, Joey Barton, a terrible human being. Google him if you want to find out what a terrible human being he is. But Ian Montone is best known as the manager of the White Stripes. He's an American music biz person. So at this very strange situation of Ian Montone, the manager of the White Stripes, and Craig Finn of the Hold Steady, sitting with us talking about the American music industry while we try to talk about football. And Ian Montone going, Joey Barton got substituted that night, got taken off and was booed off the pitch. And Ian Montone was going, "It was really unfair what everyone did to Joey, wasn't it?" And we're going, No, mate, it really wasn't. But since then, yeah. So I wouldn't say that Craig comes to... I mean, usually, because now they only come over once a year, really. And the Saturday afternoon, obviously they're doing a sound check, so he can't come to a Saturday afternoon game. But Craig has been to away games. He's been to watch QPR lose away at West Ham. He's come and stood at the terraces at the old Griffin Park and watched QPR lose away at Brentford. So, yeah, he takes an interest. He takes an interest in QPR, which is very gratifying.
That makes sense, because I know Craig's a big Minnesota Twins and Minnesota Vikings fans, and so, of course, he's going to pick a soccer team that likes to lose a lot.
Yeah, but honestly, you Americans, you don't understand the peril of losing because you do not have relegation. So you lose, still in the same league, uh-huh. Still coining in all the money. In British sport, the American sport, this is what baffles me. You know, Americans go on about individualism, and yet you have the most socialist sports system in the world. You basically have forced direction of labour through the draft. you have a closed, directed system, which you can't be broken into through free market competition. And NFL itself, you know, in an individualistic society, a sport where most of the team only have one thing to do, which attracts no glory whatever, is entirely devoted to the greater good. NFL is the model of Stalinism put into sporting action.
There's a great scene in Ted Lasso where Ted doesn't understand relegation and they're trying to explain it to him through the different leagues. And that was my first sort of interaction with that. So hearing you explain it so succinctly, especially from the optic of an American sports fan, it is really true. They don't, you know, they just play to play and it doesn't matter. There's no downside. Like,
there is no peril. There is actual peril in European sports, which is why Europe is the superior culture.
I think you got to write a book about it.
There was a soccer. There's a soccer magazine called When Saturday Comes. It's a proper magazine now, but it was originally a fanzine. And back in the 80s, they used to have a series called When Saturday Comes, Wide World of Sports, which just took an American sport each week and dismissed it. Number one was baseball, which was described as round us for cocaine addicts.
That's perfect.
That's so funny. Oh, man.
So another question from Rob, and it was also a similar question that was asked from Fiona from the UK. Your first book, Denim and Leather, was about the new wave British metal movement of the 70s and 80s. Do you see any parallels with the Unified scene and those fans in particular?
Well, all fan bases are dedicated. I mean, not really. Nwabam fans were so tribal and so unloved by anyone else. It's kind of they were perceived as and portrayed as, you know, the kind of idiots of rock fans. My God, you're liking these bands who just sing about the devil and wear spandex and look at you in your dirty leather jackets covered with patches. But the loyalty is the same. I mean, but I wouldn't say perceptions of Hold Steady fans are the same as perceptions of Nwabam fans. I mean, I think the Hold Steady fan base is generally perceived as pretty literate, fairly well educated. You know, for all that the Hold Steady play barroom rock, there isn't a great expectation that people are coming off their shifts at the factories and coming straight to the show, really, is there? I don't think there is.
No. It is interesting, you do bring up in the book, though, how much the Hold Steady drew their sort of fan interaction experience from hardcore and that scene. So, like, where it's not a parallel you would normally think when you listen to the actual music style, but that they were just so influenced by those shows that it actually led to really why the scene exists the way it does, is because of what they've learned from those early hardcore shows. And as a guy who deals in metal and works in metal, that was a very interesting realization, because going to hardcore shows, you see it. And then when you see the Hold Steady even now, there's a definite parallel, even if sonically the music couldn't be polar opposite.
Well, Craig grew up, I mean, he's talked about it a lot. He grew up on hardcore. He literally went to all ages hardcore matinee shows. And hardcore is still part of his life. He still goes to see hardcore bands. I can't remember who was. What was Walter Schriefel's band? Someone will know this, but I can't recall it. Whoever they were. He went to one of their reunion shows a couple of years ago, and he was wildly excited about it. And, you know, when I've gone to see hardcore bands, he usually knows who I'm talking about, and he knows what they are. He's heard them. So it's part of his life, the music. But yeah, the stuff that makes a huge impression on you when you're 16, 17 stays with you forever and shapes your outlook on what music should be, I think. And so for him, it was crowd participation. The thing for me when I was that age, and it stayed with me, is Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers. And that was music that was about open-heartedness and a level of emotional honesty, and that's something that I get from the Hold Steady, by which I don't mean that Craig's songs are autobiographical and say exactly what he thinks about the world, but there is emotional truth in them, and his speaking on stage even if he says the same things night after night after night, comes from a place of emotional honesty about the group. And that's something that I identified with going back to when I was a kid. And also loud, overdriven guitars.
Rounding out the fan questions, Dave from the UK asks, you've seen so many shows. Is there a song you've not seen them play live and would love to hear? And I feel like you might have covered this in the book, or I'm not sure if I'm confusing you with Rob Sheffield, because I know he brought it up as
Rob
well.
Sheffield with Curves and Nerves, which I feel a bit guilty about this sometimes. So years ago, when Led Zepp did Celebration Day, I interviewed the surviving members of Zeppelin, and I bought a copy of Led Zepp 4 on vinyl and got them all to sign it for Tad and sent it to him and said, my price for this is you let me pick a song in a Hold Steady set.
That's amazing. Went,
yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. And then, of course, he didn't. It never happened. So the first time I did a sound check, I recounted this story, and Craig was going, what? You didn't make good on this promise? And Tad, no, I'm sorry. And Craig said, what song do you want to hear? I said, I want to hear Milk Crate Mosh, because I'd never heard that live. And I don't think they played it at that point for years and years and years and years. Certainly Steve had never played it, because Tad was having to shout the chord changes across to him. Franz was quite rusty on it, but, you know, I mean, it's not a complicated song, really. But they did it, So the next day's sound check, Rob Sheffield. So, well, you played Milk Crate Mosh yesterday because, you know, Michael wanted you to play it. I would want to hear Curves and Nerves. And Chris said, no, we can't play that. But then at the 20th anniversary show at Music Hall of Williamsburg, they brought out Curves and Nerves and Milk Crate Mosh in properly worked up arrangements that the band could get mm-hmm. through. So, yeah, that was fantastic. Now, I'm trying to think. Okay, one song I haven't heard. Like, it's a minor song, but I like it. I've never heard Barely Breathing live. I would like to hear Barely Breathing.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I say to Craig quite often, why do you just play greatest hit sets with, like, the few changes? I like hearing the greatest hits. I do. And I say, you know, your audience, you are not getting people coming to see the whole study for the first time at this point. Yeah, no one is going, God, I hope they play Stuck Between Stations. And they like Stuck Between Stations, but everyone has heard it 300 times. I said, yeah, honestly, do rarities. And I wish they would more, but, you know, it's their band, not mine. And we do get to hear enough songs that are not played all the time, I think, in each show to keep most people happy. But, you know, I'm quite obsessive. I would love to hear a set of an entirely disjointed set of songs that are rarely played before. But I can see that they might think, it's not really getting the momentum, is it, when we're following Hot Fries with Curves and Nerves and Arms and Hearts and so on. You know, I mean, most of these songs we have heard at one point or another, but there are some that I just like. I'd like to see some things go into mm-hmm. rotation more. That's all. Yeah, and my favourite whole steady songs are the slow chugs, where Craig shouts a bit, and then at the end, Tad does a preposterous solo. And I appreciate they're probably not the most fun to play. They're not the most musical. You know, Charlemagne in Sweatpants is another favourite, and that's one that I begged and begged for. And then they did it a sound check in London, and then this is the first time they came over for the Weekender. And then the Sunday night show at the Lexington, which is a little club, they did a version of Charlemagne's Sweatpants that went on for about 10 minutes with Craig going into a long spiel in the middle of it. And that was just fantastic. I love that. I love when bands are spontaneous.
Yeah. I would kill to hear 40 Bucks. That's the only song I've never seen them play live. But you can't get them all, I guess.
But then there are some rarities I would gladly never hear. I don't care about the Ballad of the Midnight Hauler. Honestly, you know, Boogie, take it away. I don't need it. And it's interesting that lots of us, our least favourite song is Magazines, and they always play Magazines.
Good point. That is a good point.
You know, but it's, as I say, it's their band. Mm-hmm. They can play what they want.
Right.
I will say, though, the Brooklyn Bowl shows, the massive nights, four nights, would almost lend itself perfectly for one of those nights in the middle to be exactly what you're talking about, that mm-hmm. rarity set. Because most fans, anyway, are buying all four nights regardless. So they're going to be there. You have them. Yeah. So, like, to me, that logic of what you're saying almost would be perfect in that setting. You know, if you're going to a one-off show, maybe you don't want to bog it down because... But when you're doing a four-night residency and you know most people, you know, 80% of that audience is there all four nights, you could probably get away with that concept.
Friday and Saturday are party nights. They're always going to be the greatest hit shows. Wednesday, that's the one where they load themselves into it, you know, okay. But Thursday, and I think Thursday usually is the most interesting night of massive nights. I mean, that makes it sound like I think the others are boring, which I don't, because I fly over every year on my own money. No one is paying me to do this. You know, I'm not writing anything. I usually get some work done so I can justify claiming it back against tax in my accounts for the benefit.
Don't worry, we won't tell your government
if you're watching. I know I do. So last year I did some book stuff. I do the sound check. So I'm doing some work, but I'm going out there because I love the band and I'm paying for it myself. So, you know, I do love all four nights, but I always think Thursday is the one where the most interesting thing might happen.
Mm-hmm. So this is a great point to ask you. And this is something that's come up with some of our UK listeners that we spoke to. There's a contention between who's got the better show, the Weekenders or Massive Nights. And as someone who's been to both and clearly loves coming to Massive Nights, you're on our team, right?
I think they're different. Yeah, people going about the London crowd is wilder. London crowd is more up for it. You know, there's pogoing to halfway back in the room, and it's a bigger room as well. It's 1,500 cap, the Electric Ballroom. So, yeah, there's more sense of wildness about it. But massive nights is when I come over and I see a lot of friends who don't come to London. So, like I said, that I'm good friends with Craig. You know, I know Craig's girlfriend Angie and her sister Andrea, and I really love spending time with them, going out for dinner before the show, then going to the show, and yeah, the people that one sees wandering around. So I really like that. And this is an odd thing to explain. My wife for many years resented the Hold Steady. not because I spent so much time watching them, but because I would come back from Brooklyn so full of joy. I would say, but you know, I feel like a different person there. You know, I feel so safe and secure and in this world full of people who I know and like, and you know, I have a place in the Hold Steady world. I know that, you know, I have a place within the band's firmament. I'm aware of it and I'm very grateful for it. And it's a very gratifying, validating feeling to go over to Brooklyn and have, you know, Burton or Canty now as TM saying, hi, how many wristbands do you need? To have Gottlieb come over and greet me, to be waving at the band, to go and spend time with friends. It's wonderful. Whereas in London, the Electric Ballroom is 5 minutes walk from my house. There's not a lot of sense of event for me about going to the Electric Ballroom. I've spent many nights in the Electric Ballroom. And the other thing people often ask about me, because I don't go down in the pit. And people say, well, why don't you? Don't you want to be part of that? And it's kind of, well, no, because I don't like being surrounded by people bumping into me all the time anymore. And also, I really want to focus on the band. I love that band so much that I want to be listening to all of it and looking at all of it. So at the Electric Ballroom, I'm always up on the balcony. And I don't have a problem with that. I don't need to be, you know, being jostled and having my arms around strangers and having Howard force drinks on me. I'm very happy to just be watching and listening to the band.
So we're pretty divided on that. That's Kevin is definitely with you on the balcony, and Mike and I are down in the
Michael,
pit.
Michael, you are my soulmate right now. I totally agree with you.
So if you asked me to pick one, I would say I'd rather go to Massive Nights than the Weekender, although if you were to ask my bank manager, he would much prefer me to go to the Weekender rather than Massive Nights.
I hear that.
Well, that's good. Hopefully we could see you at this year's Massive Nights. I think we're all going to
be. Oh, you will be. Yes.
We'll be there.
I have booked accommodation. I booked flights. My entire family is coming out this time. I've said to my wife for years, come out to Brooklyn. Please do it. And once we decided to do that, my daughter's 23, my son is 20. My daughter went, I haven't been to New York for ages, it's not fair. Why would you go without me? And my wife said, oh, well, we'll take her. And once we did that, my son went, what about me? I said, well, I took you to New York in January. I still want to come. So all four of us are coming. I'll be the only one doing all four nights. I think my wife will do two or three. The kids aren't desperate to do any of them, but I've told them, you're going to have to do one. That is your price for being taken to New York. But yeah, my son came to the 20th anniversary show at Music Hall of Williamsburg. I made him come. And, well, his highlight of the night, he said, was he went outside partway through the show. He said, and like, these old guys smoking weed vapes. So like, I just, yeah, begged weed vapes off them and, yeah, got a bit stoned standing outside with them. Okay, fair enough. He said, yeah, and they were asking me what I was doing here. And I said, oh, no, my dad, he's like a writer and he knows the band. He's done this book about them. And he said, and these guys are going, oh, my God, that's awesome. So what, you just like travel the world going to rock and roll shows with your dad? And I said, no, I really don't travel the world. He doesn't travel the world going to rock and roll shows. But then they assumed that because he was my son, he must know every band who have ever mentioned connection with the Hold Steady. He said, yeah, they kept asking me about this band called, I don't know, Titus something. I said, Titus Andronicus? He went, yeah, that's them. He said, they'll go, what do you think of Titus Andronicus? I was going, what are you talking about? I don't know who they are. What do I know about that? And yeah, these 50-something American men were shocked that my 20-year-old, well, then 19-year-old son, who likes London hip hop, did not have the same musical interests as them.
So, do you find your way to the pub after the Saturday night show? You got to bring the whole family.
Well, my son, are you talking about going to
Lake Street?
Yeah,
Lake Street.
Yeah. Well, my son won't get in.
At 20, he's 19.
They ID. I'm not sure that my wife and daughter will be that desperate too. To be honest, I find Saturday night at Lake Street a bit hard work. It's just so crowded. I just can't get in. And you know, and I can't hear anyone say anything either. I'm an old man. I like to be able to have actual conversations. I feel bad about this. I feel that I should be present at Lake Street. And I do always go to Lake Street. And it kind of depends on how drunk I've got at the show. If I've got very drunk at the show, yeah, I'll stay forever. If I haven't got very drunk at the show, it's walking in and going, oh, I can't even see the bar, let alone get to it. And it's only 6 feet away. Oh, this isn't worth it.
There's no balcony at Seat at Lake Street. That's a problem. Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. This was awesome.
Thank you.
This was amazing. We could talk to you for hours. This really was a great conversation. It's probably one of my favorite episodes we've done. Yeah. Sorry, Steve.
I love talking about the Hold Steady. You know, they're my favorite band. I can talk about it until the cows come home, and none of my friends let me talk about them anymore. The minute I say the Hold, I'm cut off. Stop it! Stop it! You're not talking about them.
I sympathize with you there. That's why we started a podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when people leave newspapers, you get a page done for you. You know, with mock articles. And when I left The Guardian, my page had a long story by The Guardian's chief music writer, Alexis Petridis, detailing the Hold Steady taking anti-stalking measures against me. So, you know, that... when I left, my boss contacted the band and got a video message from Craig that was shown in the Guardian's main morning conference room with Craig thanking for my support for the Hold Steady. So, you know... It can be a bit embarrassing sometimes how much I like that band.
I sympathize.
I think we're all there with you, yeah.
I think we're all with you.
All right, that's going to do it for our interview with Michael Hann. And I just have to say, what a great time talking to him. What a great guest. We really got lost in the time. We hope you did too. The stories and just hearing him talk about his experience with the band that we all love and the reason we're listening to this and doing this podcast really was exciting and impressive. And, you know, if you're interested, you should check out his other book, Denim and Leather. I know I'm about to.
Yeah, and we just want to make sure to thank Kat from Vermont and Rob and Dave and Fiona from the UK and Lauren from St. Paul, who all submitted great questions and helped us shape this interview. So, yeah, we just want to say thank you guys because you helped us make the interview great.
All right. Yeah. What a great time. Great episode. Thanks everybody for submitting your questions. As Gasper said, we have been running a contest for the poster that Hurricane Jess made for us. And I think we have a new winner, right, Gasper, that you're going to announce?
Yeah. Andrew from Massachusetts submitted his entries and won a poster. And here's the entry from Andrew.
Hey, Hoodcat Recap. My name's Andrew. I'm just calling in about the unbelievable poster that Jess put together. This is just really, really great. And so I'll take my best crack at it. This might take longer than 90 seconds, but I'll do it in two if I need to go over. Okay, here we go. Starting at the ceiling. Number one, the diamonds coming through the drain. That's Diamonds in the Drain from Girls Like Status and Arms and Hearts. Number two, there's a lifter puller graffiti on the ceiling without the vowels, you know, the thing that Steve Barone did. Then the posters is number three, a spaceman saying, take me to your dealer from the feelers. Number four, the Cheyenne postcard from Yeah Sapphire and Cheyenne Sunrise and Sweet Part of the City. Number 5 is the Yukon Club card. That's from Sweet Pain. Number 6 is the poster of Sugar Mountain from Milk Crate Mosh. Then we go over to the newspaper clippings. Number 7 is William Butler Yeats at Sunday Night Dance Party. That's Chicago Seemed Tired Last Night. Number 8, local teen crashes boat into the harbor. That's Hurricane Jay. Number 9, a young man hospitalized after driving the wrong way down Highway 169. That's from Hornets Hornets. 10, the drop of blood, new evidence uncovered in Towny murder case. That's from One for the Cutters. Number 11 is a photo of Craig, and number 12 is a photo of Tad. I don't know. Let me keep going here. The 11 and 12 were the photos of Craig and Tad. 13 is the THRR graffiti. That's the Hood Rat recap. Number 14 is the Wave car wash air freshener. I think that's a reference to Oaks. There were kids at the car wash. If you want to be saved, all it takes is a wave. The other thing I thought it might be, the T is behind the car wash. So is that like stashed in the trash back behind the car wash from the mezzanine jip from Lifter Puller? I don't know. That's number 14. If we go to the Twin Cities map, the top row of pins, number 15, the green pin at the top off the map to the west is Osseo from Your Little Hood Rat Friend. Number 16 is the blue pin at the top. That's the Northtown Mall from Hot Soft Light. Number 17 is the white pin a little down from the blue pin and to the east. I think that's North Oaks, so maybe that's like from Oaks. Number 18, is the red pin in the newspaper articles off to the east. That's Stillwater from Your Little Hood Rat Friend. And if we keep going down through the map from there, 19, the red pin that's connected to the blue pin at the top is the neighborhood of Cleveland from One for the Cutters. 20, the green pin down from there, could be Uptown, like in the Smidge. It could be Lindale and Lake from Records and Tapes. It could be Painter's Park from Beer on the Bedstand. It could be the Schatzline Saddle Shop from Saddle Shoes. It could be the Yukon Club from Sweet Pain. Number 21 is the red pin way off the map to the west of the green. Hey, I'm sorry if I'm totally filling up your inbox here. This is just seriously just to honor the incredible work that Jess did. It's totally amazing. 21, the red pin off to the west of the green pin of the map is 169, Highway 169 from Hornets Hornets. 22, back to the green pin, south to the white pin. I think that white pin is Nicolette and 66th from Hornets and Hornets. Hornets, Hornets. Number 23, the blue pin way off the map to the west of the white pin is Paisley Park. 24, back east through the white pin and northeast to the next red pin. That's Selby and Griggs from You Gotta Dance. 25, the blue pin to the northeast of that is too far east to be Regents Hospital or Lower Town. So I think it's Payne Avenue from Sweet Pain. The two pins way off to the east, south of Stillwater, I really don't know what they are, unless the green one on Tad's photo is supposed to be like Janesville, Wisconsin. The U.S. map has 4 pins. 27, the white pin is Bay City, Michigan from Sweet Pain. 28, the red pin is Wichita, Kansas, the 5-piece out of Wichita from where Jesse's from in $40. So 29, the green pin is Grand Junction, Colorado from Grand Junction. 30, the blue pin is Ketchum, Idaho from Star 18. Okay, now we get to the things on the floor. Let me just stop here because I'm running out of time. I'll start again. Okay, the things on the floor. Number 31 is the lighter. I think that's the cigarette lighter from Mezzanine Jipoff, or maybe Fire Lighter for Hire from Cruised and Accused of Cruising. Number 32, the rattlesnake's tail is probably Snake in the Shower, or maybe it's the Chick Blame the Snake from Cattle on the Creeping Things. The Sprig of Holly, number 33, that's Holly. Number 34, the water on the floor is either Ported on the Floor from Positive Jam, or maybe it's like the Pied Piper, Lead the Kids into Rats, Lead the Rats to the Water from Man Park. 35, the pills. I think it's Pills and Powders, Powders and Pills from The Swish, but it could also be Crushing Up Pills and Pouring Out the Pills from Sixers. 36, the cigarette butts. Cigarette butts are all over the place, but I'm going to go with Don't All the Cigs Make You Tired from Hurricane J. 37, the bloodstains. I'm going to go with They're Bleeding on the Floor from Sketchy Metal, but maybe it's bleaching out the blood stains because that goes with Diamonds in the Drain from Girls Like Status. There's a bunch about the floor, right? Like the hardwood floors from Solid Gold Soul or Touch My Stuff and Lifter Puller, or maybe Sit Down on Your Floor and Listen to Your Records from We Can Get Together. I don't know what the bullets are. Maybe it's shooting through the ceiling to go with Bleeding on the Floor from Sketchy Metal. or all the shells made me think of you from Unpleasant Breakfast. And I don't know what the spray can is. I think it's just for the graffiti. Okay, the blue and red wheels are spinners up on the over on the right-hand side. The ticker tape is from Wheelchairs, Guns, and Ticker Tape from Positive Jam. Let's get to the stacks of records. The right-hand stack from the floor up, Been Caught Stealing from Jane's Addiction. That's mentioned in Charlamagne and Sweatpants. The pink and green striped one drove me crazy. I would have like called into you guys 4 days ago, but I've been trying to remember what the hell that is. I really, really want to know what the pink and green one is. I don't. 41 is The Crew, 7 Seconds. That would be the early 7 Seconds from Stay Positive. 42, Let It Be, The Replacements. 43, A Blessing and a Curse, Drive-By Truckers, good friends of the band. 44, Versus God from Dillinger 4, even better friends of the band. The center stack, 45 is a VHS cassette of Opening Night, directed by John Cassavetes, starring Gina Rowlands, mentioned in Slapped Actress. 46 is Andre Simone, Surviving in the 80s, mentioned in The Swish. 47 is Separation Sunday. 48 is the back of In Color and in Black and White, the Cheap Trick mentioned in Rock Problems. 49 is We All Want the Same Things, I think, or maybe it's Stay Positive, but I think it's We All Want the Same Things, Craig's solo album. 50 is Bones Brigade video mentioned in Hornets, Hornets. I don't know what the Search For video is. 51 is Almost Killed Me, and 52 is Fiestas and Fiascos. Okay, I'll wrap that up and get to the last one. Okay, last bit. At the table, 53 is the three hood rats, the rats with hoodies from your little hood rat friend. 54, the crown, halo, and headphones are for James King, King James, and James Dean at the table in the corner of the unified scene from Sweet Pain. 55 is the blue hoodie. It says, What Would Judas Do? From Milk Crate Mosh. 56, the sunset colored hoodie says, Lift or Puller. The brown hoodie, I can't tell what music pub is. Don't know what that is. So number 57, the blue hoodie rat is holding cards. I think it's one of the hands dealt by the dealers in La Quereria from Lift or Puller. 58, the brown hoodie rat is holding a pipe. Maybe he's the boy with the pipe in his face from Katrina and the K-Hole. Number 59 is the pile of poker chips, reference to Chips Ahoy. Number 60, the two $20 bills are a reference to the two 20s from 40 bucks. 61, the margarita, Bloody Mary, and the appointment to eat some soup together at the Motel 6 are from 212 Margarita. I don't know what the microphone is. I don't know what the Bowie LP or Dowie LP is. And I don't know what the gold bar in the middle is. But the last, very last one, number 62, is the very cool little card. In the podcast, Jess said that this is her card. And it's a hurricane coming out of a J. It's awesome. The whole thing is awesome. She's awesome. I don't know if it's too late for me to win this thing or get involved in this thing at all, but you should just say that she's an incredible person and an incredible artist. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Andrew, for your submission there. Boy, I think he saw more things in the poster than I ever knew were possible. He's got so many things listed off there that I had no idea that I had forgotten about. So thank you. I hope you're enjoying your copy of the poster there, Andrew. So, and I think that's going to do it for us today, guys. What do you think?
Another great episode in the books, guys. This one was fun. Thanks everybody for listening. We hope you enjoyed this one. This really was a special one for all three of us getting to talk to Michael Hann. If you like what we do, make sure you give us a like, a follow, drop a comment on our socials, leave us a speak pipe, whichever. We do this because you guys listen, and your support is the reason we keep putting out these episodes. So we want to thank the scene for listening.
Yeah, and if you're looking for those socials or how to get in contact with us, or if you're just looking for past episodes or the present episode, head over to our link tree. It's linktr.ee/thehoodratrecap, and you can find all things The Hood Rat Recap there. It's a great jumping off point. All right, so I'm Gasper. That's Mike. That's Kevin. And that was Michael Hann, author of The Gospel of the Hold Steady, How a Resurrection Really Feels. And us guys, and all you guys and gals, we are all the Hood Rat Recap Podcast. Killer party songs, killer.
Pretty good, Mike. But you know what?
Shut up, Jeremy.